Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a story about surviving heroin addiction. But first, amid increasing violence in Afghanistan, foreign envoys there say the country needs less corrupt politicians. After meeting in Paris yesterday, the envoys said they have no preference whether there should be a runoff after last month's presidential election. To avoid that, the winner needs 50% of the vote. Joining us from Kabul is Washington Post editor Rajiv Chandrasekaran. And Rajiv, let's start with the fraud charges. The votes are still being counted. At this point, though, it looks like incumbent President Hamid Karzai is leading. The Election Commission has to sift through some 2,600 complaints of fraud. What's happening?
The complaints keep piling in by the day. And this is going to be an incredibly thorny issue to sort out. The belief over here is that Karzai will come pretty close to that 50% mark, if not higher, but the Election Commission will then have to sort through a number of these things, and there may well be a significant number of ballots that will be excluded because of cases of fraud that will be investigated. But all this is casting a big cloud over the post-election period at a time when Afghanistan really needs a legitimate government to move ahead with the very crucial process of rebuilding this country, of getting more effective governance down at the province and local level. Things are in a state of suspended animation here, and that is, of course, causing a great deal of concern for all of the nations that have troops in this country trying to combat the Taliban insurgency and trying to bring a degree of stability to this place.
Can you give me an example of one of the more significant complaints of fraud from the election?
Well, there have been reports in one province that at a number of polling sites, literally hundreds of ballots have been identically marked for Hamid Karzai were sent back to Kabul. In some cases, the identical number of ballots from a number of different polling sites in a province, videos that have surfaced of people just sort of jamming in multiple ballots into ballot boxes, seemingly all manner of election day type fraud is being alleged in this election.
And does the country's Election Commission have the resources or a plan to investigate all of this?
Well, they have very limited investigative capabilities, and this is not an entirely impartial group. Some of the members have some clear allegiances to President Karzai, and so there is some concern whether this body will be acting in the most impartial manner possible.
Mm-hmm. What about the U.S.? The U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, Richard Holbrooke, was at that meeting that we talked about in Paris yesterday, denying reports that there had ever been a tense meeting between him and Hamid Karzai. Is the U.S. Working with the Afghan government here?
Well, the U.S. is working with the Election Commission, offering to provide necessary sort of support to help with their efforts here. With regard to the meeting between Holbrooke and the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, and President Karzai, it all depends on how you define tense. The U.S. embassy has stated that nobody shouted, nobody walked out of the room, but President Karzai, by a number of reports, was upset that the U.S. Did not essentially come out and endorse what he believed to be his victory, and felt that the U.S. Was essentially acting in a way that suggested it was trying to unseat him. There's been a degree of tension there between Karzai and the Obama administration.
When do you think we might have official results from the election?
Well, there are results that are supposed to be announced on Monday, although that always could be delayed.
Okay, very briefly, Rajiv, because we're running out of time. In addition to these fraud charges in the election, we've also been hearing about increasing sophistication of the Taliban. And then, of course, there's a new UN report about a big cash crop in Afghanistan, which is opium. The UN report says opium production is down sharply, but the country still has huge stockpiles. What's going on there?
Well, opium production is down because over the past couple of years, opium production was sky high and was essentially overproduction. So that because the price of poppy was falling, farmers switched to other crops. But that does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that the poppy problem is being solved. And what the UN notes is that there's an increasing concern that larger drug cartels are forming to smuggle some of that poppy out. Obviously, a concern that some of that the proceeds from those drug sales are funding the Taliban insurgency here. So despite the drop in production, officials here say that the poppy problem still remains very significant and is something that has to continue to be addressed.
Washington Post editor Rajiv Chandrasekaran joined us from Kabul. Rajiv, thanks very much.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opium, the raw material for heroin. And we want to turn now to a sad but hopeful story about heroin addiction. There aren't many people who can say they've been able to lift themselves up from being a homeless junkie to working as an award-winning journalist, a creative writing professor, an author, and most recently, a Hollywood screenwriter and actor. But Richie Farrell can. And he tells the story in his new book, What's Left of Us, A Memoir of Addiction.
Now you want to go left here. This is Adam Street. This is the infamous Adam. All these are new.
Farrell recently took us around his native city of Lowell, Massachusetts, to tell us his story of being a homeless addict in the 1980s to now working on the set of the movie The Fighter in Lowell with celebrities like Mark Wahlberg. The film is based in part on Farrell's documentary High on Crack Street.
You know, I was a junkie here 22 years ago. Then I came back 5 years clean to make High on Crack Street. Then years later, I was involved in the movie itself for the past 2.5 years as screenwriter, working with the script. And then I auditioned for myself, and the director chose me to play. So I have a trailer with my name on. I opened the door, and Wahlberg's trailer's over there. You know, it's surreal.
And Farrell's start as an addict is almost as unlikely. He's now 53 years old, and he looks back fondly on his childhood in Lowell, growing up near extended family in a working-class, predominantly Irish neighborhood centered by St. Patrick's Catholic Church.
This was St. Patrick's, where I was an altar boy.
Now the church is a big part of your book.
A lot of
stuff happened here.
A lot of stuff happened there. Right over there is where the hearse, and when my father's body came down this street, and again, this is all torn down, but those type of tenement buildings, all the junkie runners were standing out there waving to me. I had just been there earlier and got 2 bags of heroin and shot 2 bags of heroin as I was in the hearse going over here to St. Patrick's to give the eulogy at my father's funeral.
In that eulogy, Farrell says he did not tell the truth about his father. He was a teacher, well-liked and well-known in Lowell, a devout Catholic, but in private, Farrell says his father was an abusive man who would not accept that his son was born with a limp. So he developed an exhaustive exercise regimen, pushed the younger Farrell to play football, was devastated when that ended with an injury, and Farrell says his father wanted him, above all else, to be tough.
He threw a birthday party for me. And at the party, we had all these gifts, and the people all left, and there was one huge box on the table. He wouldn't let me open it. And after they all left, he took me downstairs to the playroom, and we opened it. It was a set of boxing gloves. We put it on, and he beat me from one end of the playroom to the other until I collapsed hysterically in his arms, just crying. And I'll never forget it. He said, "Rich, I did this for you because the world's going to be tough on you. You're going to get knocked down, and you're going to have to get up again. Someday you'll understand why I did this. I did this for you."
And do you think that's why you started doing drugs?
I became a pretty crazy football player. I was big. I was strong. You know, my father's pushed me, and I was a pretty crazy kid. So, I smoked pot back then, and I was strong and I was pretty good in football, and I was in a game, an all-star game, and I got a cracked back block. It was a legal chop block, and it blew out my knee, and I fell in love with Percodans. It was back when the doctors didn't have a computer system where you could check, you know, who was giving you. So I had about 5 doctors
Get the Percodans.
Get the Percodans.
So you were
from.
Addicted to painkillers first.
I found out something. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. I found out that narcotics not only took away the physical pain, but they did an unbelievable job to destroy the emotional pain. Mm-hmm. And when my father walked away from me, when I couldn't play football, he wanted me to go to Notre Dame, when all that, and he didn't talk to me anymore, when I couldn't live out, he was this guy that I loved, wouldn't talk to me. It was just an ideal thing to kill all the pain.
Killing pain was also what took Farrell from prescription drugs to heroin, and the pain this time was worse. Farrell was with his father the night he died in 1984, but he didn't talk about it for years, and it haunted him. Basically what happened was that Farrell's mother was in the hospital after minor surgery and wasn't able to reach his father by phone. She was worried because his father had a heart condition, so she called Farrell and asked him to go to the house and check on his dad. When Farrell did, he found him with another woman.
And so I pulled the garage door, went up the stairs, and they were involved in their passion on the kitchen floor. And I freaked. I lost her. I threw her out the back with her clothes and everything, right out the back porch. And I pulled up a chair next to my father, and it was on the floor, and started talking to him, saying, "Dad, all this hypocrite, you go to Mass and communion every day. What is it to wash away your sins?" My father had a habit of doing a red fox imitation, where he'd grab his heart and pretend he was having a heart attack. Well, he did it this day. And all of a sudden, his bottom lip started to turn purplish-blue and started to swell. And I realized that he wasn't faking. But he died there in my arms. And I just held his head. And I kind of lost it and said, don't die, you son of a bitch. You know, everything that... I had, it's hard for me to talk about this, but everything that I had that was gone right there on the floor. I do all right sometimes talking about it, but it's tough. If you think it's tough now, then that vision that I just told you guys was in my brain every morning when I woke up, and the only thing that took it away was a bag of heroin.
And what was your day like, pretty much, when you were a junkie?
First thing you do was, how are you going to get high? You do whatever you had to do to get high, whether it was to rob people, sell drugs on the streets to people, go into Zayas and department store stewards and steal things and sell them to pawn shops, whatever you had to do.
That's Richie Farrell talking about his life as a junkie during the 1980s. When we come back, he'll tell us how he was sent to detox, treated with Librium, and how, when he was finally able to tell that story about his father's death, he was also able to beat heroin. And later in the show, why states are racing to change laws measuring teacher performance. The bottom line is a competition for federal education dollars. We'll be back after a break. Here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now and our conversation with author, screenwriter, and former heroin addict Richie Farrell in Lowell, Massachusetts.
All the way up this river, from one end to the other, were mills, because they got their power off the Merrimack River back in the textile days. That's where everybody worked. That's where the Irish came.
Farrell was born in Lowell, and this spot he's taken me to amid a torrential downpour is where he almost died 22 years ago. Farrell grew up a few blocks from here in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. He worked in real estate, got married, and had two kids, but his continuing struggle to come to terms with his father's abuse and his father's death led him to drugs, eventually to heroin. In the 1980s, Farrell was a homeless junkie seeking shelter in an abandoned textile mill building where he tried to commit suicide with two other junkies.
We're actually sitting in our car. It's raining pretty hard. We were actually sitting right where a mill building was that was torn down.
It was here that you tried to kill yourself.
Right here.
Why? Why did you try to kill yourself?
Well, you know, I figured personally, I had a couple kids that I thought, you know, about my father and what he had done to me. And I always wanted to be a better father to my children than he was to me, and I wanted to love them. And I thought that when I saw my kids that last time when I went over to see them and I was crying, they didn't want me to go, I really believed that my kids would be better off if I was dead. Right here on the second floor is when we put too many bags in the cooker and pulled the trigger and said, this is it. I mean, people do it all the time.
Trying to kill themselves.
It's not new, yeah. When you just don't want to cope anymore, when you just say, I can't rob, I can't steal, I'm a lowlife, my life's not worth anything. When you wake up and you don't want to live anymore, you get to that point. So, you know, you talk to people who have a son, daughter, or a loved one that died of heroin overdose, I would say a good 70% of them do it on purpose. They check out. It's an easy way to go. You just go to sleep. You put too much in the cooker, you just fire it, and all of a sudden you just nod off, and your heart stops.
Here, though, when you were here, and you were probably at the lowest of the low, right, for you, really, when you wanted to kill yourself, somebody found you.
From what I hear, there were three kids playing in the mall. They went out screaming and went screaming over there, and they called an ambulance, and they came, and they have these cocktails. I forget what they're called. In the ambulance, it's adrenaline. Yes. And shoot it right through your heart. And we lived.
And then they took you to detox.
Yeah, took you to detox. And
you had been to Lowell Detox about half a dozen times already.
Maybe I think it could be eight times that I was there altogether.
Can we drive over to where detox was?
Yeah.
Let's head over there. Okay. Is it far from here?
No, across the river. Across the river.
Right. So why do you think people become addicts? Is it because of what it feels like to be high?
Heroin, and why it's so destructive, it's the best way to describe it to people who haven't taken it. It's like riding the peak of an orgasm. Those seconds right before people orgasm, or your orgasm, that you ride for like a two-hour period. And that's why it's so euphoric. It's so captivating. That's the best way to describe it.
Lowell Detox is now Lowell General Hospital's Cancer Center, a clean, modern building, very different from the place where Farrell spent a key week of his life.
Oh, so this is Lowell Detox. This building here, it's amazing. It's the first time I've been up here. This is amazing.
Farrell is visibly nervous as we go inside. It was here where he was finally able to end his three-year battle with heroin to go on to the life he has now as an author, professor, and Hollywood screenwriter.
My insides right now as I'm sitting here are a little bit nervous. It's pretty amazing right upstairs here. Spent 7 days and left here on April 1st, 1987. And never shot another bag of heroin.
Why do you think you were able to finally get away from heroin and get away from that?
There's no doubt it's a spiritual thing. I can't really explain it. I had this, you know, whether it's God, the Holy Spirit, I don't know, but I got lucky. When I talk to kids, I say, listen, guys, I want to tell you, now pay attention to this first statement. I took heroin once, and after that, heroin took me to any place it wanted to. And my point is, this is not an experimental drug. This is not marijuana. This is something that's going to grab you by the seat of the pants and take control. Kids today are getting hooked on back in my day it was a Percodan, today it's OCs, OxyContin. Mm-hmm. So they go to the street where it's $30, $40 for a little pill. Now all of a sudden comes Lady Heroin coming in from Afghanistan. $5 a bag. They say, I'm not going to be a junkie. I'm just going to snort it. And they get fooled real quick. Because when you wake up in the morning as an addict, you have two choices, only two choices. Repeat or recover. That's it.
Was it hard in these 22 years then? Or do you think you found sort of the strength in those 7 days here to carry you through? You must have still had the craving for heroin.
No, you know what I had the craving for? It wasn't the craving for heroin per se. It was the anxiety attacks. It was knowing, and this is kind of weird, it was knowing that all I had to do was go from where I was living on Lafayette Street down to Adam Street. You know, a five-minute walk and a little bag of white powder would take all this anxiety away. I used that April 1st as my birthday. I used the date that I left, that I was at. You know, while you're in the hospital, you don't have access to heroin. But the first day you hit the street, you can do anything. So that's the day that you take for, you know, your birthday when you celebrate and how long you've been. So I'm young. I'm only 22 years old. What, don't I look it? What, are you laughing at
me? No.
She's laughing at me.
That's Richie Farrell in Lowell, Massachusetts. His new book about his life as an addict is What's Left of Us, A Memoir of Addiction. You know I took the poison from the poison stream. Then I floated out of here. To see photos of Richie Farrell and learn more about his life, go to our website, hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now. 70 years ago this week, Germany invaded Poland and World War II began. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain made this announcement on the BBC on September 3rd, 1939.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Even as Chamberlain spoke, thousands of people, most of them school children, were being evacuated from Britain's cities and towns to the safety of the countryside. The British called it Operation Pied Piper.
We're on number 12 platform at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. We're on number 12 platform, the train's in, and the children are just arriving, coming along in their school groups with a banner in front saying what school they are, the tiny tots in front, leading up to the bigger ones, the 12, 13-year-olds behind. And here comes a high school, more like 14, 15, and 16. They're being evacuated too.
One of the ways Britain is marking this 70th anniversary of the start of the war is with an exhibition inside the underground bunker Prime Minister Churchill used during the war. The BBC's Martin Plaut reports.
Just around the corner from Parliament, tucked beneath an anonymous government building, is an unobtrusive grey door. It doesn't look like much, but in 1939 it was at the heart of government. When the bombers flew overhead and the sirens sounded, the heads of the armed forces and Prime Minister Winston Churchill needed somewhere safe from which to run the war. It was this bunker that they came to. Here, deep underground, are map rooms, gun racks, a telephone system on which to speak to the American president, but also the necessities of life. There's a bedroom with a narrow bed, complete with a green quilt, in which Churchill slept, but also the desk from which he gave four of his famous wartime speeches.
Little did he know the spirit of the British nation, or the tough fighter of the Londoners, whose forebears played a leading part.
70 years on, an exhibition has opened to bring home the importance of the cabinet war rooms to a new generation. The curator is Cressida Finch.
We wanted to introduce people to all the different staff who worked here, including the dispatch riders and the typists and the marine guards. Particularly along this very corridor, so here at the heart of the cabinet war rooms, they were doing things like preparing battle orders. One of the people we interviewed talked about writing the battle orders for D-Day from down here.
And just how many people operated from these rather cramped quarters?
We think up to about 400 at a time. It started off very small, but by the end of the war, there are about 100 rooms down here.
And just how important was it to the British war effort?
And this is where the heart of government and military command was stationed. This is where the war cabinet meetings were being held. This is where the most important war planning was taking place.
Myra Collier, now in her 80s, was among the young women who worked here.
When I first came down here, I was absolutely terrified of all the corridors. I didn't know where I was and what I was doing. I got used to it, but it was a treat to get upstairs and get into fresh air. And if you did 12-hour days, and you came off at night, you were, well, the whole time without any light. So we were like pit ponies.
Even after an hour in the war rooms, it was with relief that I surfaced into the fresh air of a late summer's day. The cabinet war rooms were a vital part of Britain's wartime government.
The BBC's Martin Plaut in London. And before we go today, in the tradition of Woody Guthrie, new music about what it's like to work in the 21st century recession. Back after a quick break, here and now. President Obama wants to link teacher pay to student performance, and he's holding out billions of federal stimulus dollars to get states to go along. The president's Race to the Top program is doling out $4.3 billion in education grants, but the money comes with strings attached. The most controversial would require states to judge teachers based on student test scores. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to change the laws in his state to meet that condition, and other states have already done so. Allison Klein is covering this story for Education Week. And Allison, can you explain what the Race to the Top program is calling for?
Well, the Race to the Top program was created as part of the stimulus, and it's set up to reward states, basically, who do a good job of making sure that teachers are equitably distributed throughout the state, meaning that the least experienced teachers don't end up in the lowest performing schools. It also rewards states who create high-quality assessments, meaning tests for students, and it also takes a look at the way that states turn around their lowest-performing schools.
And as we said, the big issue here is linking teacher pay to student performance.
Yes. Well, the Department of Education put out some proposed criteria for how they would judge states for the Race to the Top competition. And one of the things that states absolutely must do in order to qualify for one of these grants, and they're highly coveted because so many states are in such dire financial straits, is that they have to make sure that it's possible in their state data systems to take a look at how a teacher is doing as compared to their students' test scores.
The Department of Ed also is saying that it would like states to not have any caps on charter schools as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But again, that's something that they would encourage. It's not necessarily something that's a must, as the data system provision would be.
And so because of this, these are big changes, and they're affecting California. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is proposing several things, like removing the cap on charter schools and like changing the state law so it can get in the race for some of this federal stimulus money. What are some of the other things that he's proposing?
Well, he's also taking a look at the way the state pays teachers. He wants to see alternative pay. Basically, it's like merit pay, paying teachers who've shown results with their students more.
Based on standardized test scores?
That could be a component of a merit pay system, yes. He also wants to see a change in the way that the state measures student performance. He would like to see them look at students' progress from year to year. He also wants to see more of an emphasis on turning around low-performing schools, especially the very lowest-performing schools in the state.
I imagine that teachers' unions are not happy with this.
No, they're actually opposed to most of the ideas that Governor Schwarzenegger has put forward. They've launched a statewide and actually a national campaign questioning a lot of this. And one of the things that they point out is that these are not finalized regulations yet. What's come out about Race to the Top, and they're not sure that it makes sense for the state to change its laws to go after what's really a pretty small slice of money. California has a $26 billion deficit. Even if they gave all of the Race to the Top money to California, which certainly they won't do, it wouldn't even come close to closing their deficit. And the teachers' unions out there are saying, let's hold off, let's wait a moment before we completely change our laws for what's really just proposed at this point criteria.
So at this point, then, this possible condition to the federal stimulus money is that the states get rid of the cap on charters and that states tie teacher performance to student test scores. But those are not finalized as yet. Do we know when they might be finalized?
Hopefully this fall we'll see some finalized regulations.
What about other states? aside from California? What are they doing?
Some other states are planning on taking a look at their state data laws. Wisconsin, there's some interest there from the governor. There's some interest from the state chief, at least, in Nevada. And then in New York, one state lawmaker, Sam Hoyt, wrote a letter to Governor Patterson saying, hey, you know, California is going to be doing this special session to change their data laws. I think that's something that we should do in New York. And obviously the teachers union there is opposed to that.
I read that the education commissioner in Vermont says that smaller rural states like Vermont could be hurt because in many areas they only have one school. They're very small schools. They can barely fill the seats in those classrooms, so they can't really offer a charter school option. Is that a big concern for a lot of other places?
Yes, that's certainly a huge concern when it comes to the race to the top criteria. A lot of rural schools say that not only does the charter option not really work very well for them, but they're also concerned about merit pay. Paying teachers more out there just doesn't make enough of a difference. There just isn't enough competition for the teachers' jobs out there. And also, especially when it comes to Secretary Duncan's emphasis on turning around low-performing schools, some of what he wants schools to do is close and send the students to other schools. And obviously that would be a tough thing if you're the only school around for 100 miles or so.
You know, a lot of this sounds like a lot more federal regulation in education, which some folks thought was going to change under President Obama, and there might be a little bit of a stepping back from No Child Left Behind, but this seems like it's going in the other direction.
Well, you could argue that, but again, Race to the Top is the competitive grant program. States don't have to take this money. They don't have to comply with these steps. No Child Left Behind was money that states were used to getting, and they had to do extra things for money that was kind of already part of their funding bloodstream, whereas Race to the Top is a carrot. It's an extra.
But the economy is also in horrible shape, and everybody's struggling.
That's absolutely true. So in some ways, it does put states in a difficult position and would be seen as a lot more federal regulation. However, the department is giving states also unprecedented resources.
So in the fall, we should have things finalized in terms of what the criteria might be for states to apply for some of this money. And then when would they find out, and when might there be some sort of a resolution in California?
Governor Schwarzenegger is hoping that in early October, his state will have changed the laws and passed his reform package. The very first grants, there's going to be a couple rounds of Race to the Top funding, and the first round won't go out until March.
Allison Klein of Education Week, she's been speaking with us about how some states are changing their laws to try to get federal stimulus money for education. Allison, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Now for some other news we're following. Firefighters have contained about a third of the massive wildfire that's been burning for the past 8 days near Los Angeles. Some residents are being allowed back into their homes. Holly Pappas of La Crescenta says elite firefighters known as hotshots helped save her house.
The hotshots came in and they cleared a nice trench about 10 feet from my back fence line. And that fire came right up to that trench. It was so surreal to watch the video of what happened, and I'm just overjoyed. I have my neighborhood back.
But not everybody was so lucky. More than 60 homes were destroyed. Two firefighters were killed. Fire officials hope to fully contain the blaze in another week and a half. Also, the healthcare debate is getting more bizarre and violent. A man at a pro-healthcare reform rally in Thousand Oaks, California, got ticked off at a group of protesters. Here's Captain Frank O'Hanlon of the Ventura County Sheriff's Department.
That gentleman and our victim, a 65-year-old male, got into a fistfight. The fistfight deteriorated to the point where the 65-year-old male had his left little finger bitten off.
Police are looking for the attacker. The man who lost half his finger was protesting health care reform. Doctors were able to reattach the finger, and it turns out Medicare will pick up the tab. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. This is Altar of the Bottom Line, the title song on a new CD by Tom Jurevich.
I grew up at a time when a man could make his own fate by the sweat of his brow, by the work he'd do, by what his hands could make.
Jurevich is a professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The songs reflect Jurevich's interviews with teachers, call center workers, and factory employees about their jobs. Annie joins us from the studios of WFCR. And Tom, did you find a common theme among the workers you spoke with?
I think the common theme here is just that with this economy and with the pressure from outside and the growing unemployment is that people feel an awful lot of pressure on the job to work not just every hour, every minute, every second, to really be on 24/7, feeling like they really have to perform extraordinary things just to keep those jobs, to hold on to that work.
There's a song on the CD titled Factory of Broken Dreams. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
I wanted to be a teacher. I thought that I'd be good working with children. At least my mama thought I could. So I started off at college, but it was all too big and new. I was back in Southie before the year was through.
Tell me, what's that song about, Tom?
Well, I had a conversation with a call center worker at Verizon in Andover, Massachusetts, and she was talking about her work and the kinds of monitoring and the pressures to sell and so on, but she sat back in her chair, and she said, you know, when I look around this place, what do I see? I see a factory of broken dreams. Because nobody ever wanted to be a telephone worker when they grew up as a child. They had more grandiose hopes of being nurses and teachers, and we've all ended up here. And it's maybe a place for us to earn some money, but it really doesn't house our dreams anymore. So it was a beautiful quote that I was able to take in that story to put into that song.
Did you ever meet anybody who was hopeful?
Oh, I met lots of people who were hopeful. And, you know, the amazing thing about it is, despite these difficult working conditions, is that people themselves are very hopeful. They're hopeful for their families. They're hopeful for their kids. They're hopeful for their own future. I spoke with some Guatemalan immigrants, undocumented workers, and a young man who was my son's age worked 2 minimum wage jobs, 80 hours a week. You know, an astronomical number of hours to work. He did that for 4 years and saved $10,000 to send back home so his family could buy the first piece of land they've owned in 4 generations. And he is so proud of that. He's so proud of that. And so people do have capacities to hold on to these threads of life to move them forward. But at the same time, I don't think we should just simply say we should let the workplace be. I think it's time that we really look at what people do every day at work, and even in these difficult times, to start asking some hard questions about why nurses, for example, are working double shifts or 60 hours a week, or why we force people at minimum wage to work 2 jobs so they can make ends meet. I think these are really powerful questions that these workers have helped me to understand that we need to address in this society.
We actually have a song on the CD about immigrants. It's called Immigrants Like Me. Let's listen to that.
You see us in the morning, come out of the shadow. Workers look a lot like me. Work in the back rooms, the kitchens and the laundries, the places you don't see.
I wrote that song because it seems like so many times we want them to be here, we just don't want them to be in public. We want to hide them away. We're happy for them to do our dirty work, but we don't want them to be part of our society. And again, that quote came from listening and to those workers. And I think sometimes listening is the most powerful things that we can do as a songwriter or as a sociologist, to listen to people and to really try to understand lives from their perspective.
Besides your songs on this CD, there are also songs that really reflect the tradition of work and labor songs. There's one by Billy Bragg and a song by Woody Guthrie called I Ain't Got No Home. You have your guitar with you. Can you play part of that for us?
I'd be happy to.
I ain't got no home, just a ramblin' round, just a wandering worker, roam from town to town. The police make it hard, boys, wherever I may go. I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Why did you choose this song, Tom, this Woody Guthrie song?
What I really like about it is that it was written at the end of the 1930s when times were really hard and the whole country was going through a sea change. And I think we're really going through that same kind of a sea change right now. I mean, manufacturing workers have really taken it on the chin, and, and the world that they knew isn't going to exist anymore. And for them, it's not just about losing income. It's about losing their whole community, their friends, and in some ways, losing their home. And this song always spoke deeply to me about our need to have home and how work is part of that home.
There is power in a factory, power in land, power in hands of a worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There's power in a union.
And what about unions? Why haven't we seen more progress on the part of unions to be able to protect working conditions for some workers?
Well, unions are still incredibly important. And in many ways, a union card is the only thing that stands between a worker and a minimum wage job. But I think it's wrong to see that unions haven't responded. I think unions are doing some wonderful and exciting things. Again, they are organizing immigrants. They're organizing in healthcare. And they have stood the line in many important ways. And I think they're in a rebuilding phase right now, and it's going to take some time for labor to get back on its feet. But this is not a movement that's over. And it's been down on its back before. And I think what the long view of history gives us is just how strong and resilient they can be. Hopefully we'll be a part of making these jobs better in the future to give some sense of bread and roses back to workers in this country.
Remind us what bread and roses means.
Bread and roses comes from a strike in 1912 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where the workers struck. And they had a slogan, bread and roses, because what the slogan meant was they wanted the wages enough for them to feed their families, to take care of their children, but they wanted more. They wanted some dignity and respect, ability to have a life and be a community member. So that slogan, bread and roses, is in some ways the gold standard for working people, that we want some money, but we also want the dignity and respect to have a decent life.
And we're just a few days away from Labor Day now, and most people, probably Labor Day 2009, will be either at picnics or at the beach, if the weather permits, not really thinking about labor on this holiday.
Absolutely. We've seen it become a more of a recreational holiday than a focus on labor, but I guess what I'd ask everybody is to look around at the people who are working and give them a sense of your appreciation for what they do, and also talk to them. Hear their stories. I think it's powerful to listen sometimes. So when you got a minute in that restaurant or at that toll booth or even at the beach, take some time and listen to those voices and see how much they resonate with your own.
Right. Tom Jurevich is a professor of labor studies at the University of Massachusetts. His new CD is The Altar of the Bottom Line. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
Stop my old truck at the crossroad. Guess I need a little time. How can I break it to my family? Come, this is the shutting down the mine.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again. Here and Now.